As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Jonathan Ferrow, along with Lisa Abramowitz and Anne-Marie Hordern. Join us each day for insight from the best in markets, economics, and geopolitics. From our global headquarters in New York City, we are live on Bloomberg Television weekday mornings from 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen. And as always, on the Bloomberg Terminal and the Bloomberg Business App.
John, of course, there is a meeting between the Secretary of State and the leader of China, also a meeting between the China Foreign Minister, Wang Yi, who accused the U.S. of taking endless measures to suppress China's economy. This was a conversation of more than 5 hours over a working lunch. John, do you think the United States has managed to get its point of view across whereby the Chinese will change their mind about some of this language? It's not fair competition, but containment. It's not removing risks, but creating risks.
I mean, the language isn't really the problem here. You've got two countries that are clearly on a continued collision course that are going to continue to be each other's antagonists, both in the economic sphere, but also the geopolitical sphere. So, you know, these kinds of conversations should probably be seen as positive just because they're happening. But the real issues here are what Blinken said in his speech just there, that the Chinese continue to support Russian material in its war against Ukraine. That they're buying this Iranian oil that the U.S. is okay with for now, but would probably prefer to get the Iranian oil off the market, particularly if Donald Trump comes back in. And you've got this ongoing threat of tech competition, which is sort of looming in the background of the relationship where a lot of American companies are trying to decouple and divest away from China because of the increased threat they perceive, both in the operating environment in China, but also America's politicians' very hawkish turn towards China that could lead potentially to a sudden stop in relations at some point down the road.
John, let's sit on geopolitics then. The amount of influence that Beijing has over Iran, has over Russia, and the amount of influence the U.S. has over China to do something about it. How much influence do both sides have?
I mean, the U.S.'s influence here comes in the form of sanctions. They could sanction Chinese entities that are buying Iranian oil. They could sanction more Chinese entities that are supplying dual-use goods to Russia. They're not yet, in order to preserve the relationship and maintain gas prices, but they have the powers to do so. I think the Chinese influence over those two countries matters, and there's probably quite a few things going on behind the scenes that we don't exactly know about in terms of how they're supporting Russia, how they're supporting Iran, potentially how they're supporting the regime in Venezuela. There's just things we don't know. And that material support plus the strategic support probably helps those regimes counter American influence, which is in some ways helpful for the Chinese in their long-term goals.
John, how much do you think that this administration in China is more willing to work with President Biden because they prefer him over the alternative?
I think they've had a decent relationship with Biden, but it hasn't been all great. And if you look at the trajectory of the relationship under Biden compared to President Trump, it's largely the same. Biden did nothing to reduce the tariff complex that was created by the Trump administration, and he's gone significantly further than the Trump administration on cutting off Chinese access to U.S. semiconductors and other advanced technologies, and potentially is setting up to do even more in a second Biden administration. Now, the Trump administration is probably going to do a lot of that same stuff. So I sort of wonder from the Chinese perspective if they really care which of these men wins the White House in November. One thing the Biden administration has done a little bit differently has been a lot more multilateral. They've been able to align a lot of U.S. allies in favor of their initiatives. The Trump administration struggled to do that a little bit more. But we have now this precedent set where, you know, we've got this increasing kind of tech competition, this tech cold war happening between these two countries that's likely to continue no matter who wins in November.
You know, we talk about TikTok. They didn't discuss it. And yet the specter kind of hangs over a lot of American businesses as well. When they try to figure out what kind of retaliation can they expect from Xi Jinping, from China, if there is some sort of TikTok ban or forced divestment, do you see this as something that Xi Jinping is willing to do to really divorce the relationship between the United States businesses and China even more?
Well, on the issue of TikTok, to me, it's really interesting. The news yesterday indicates that ByteDance is willing to let, you know, shut down TikTok operations in the U.S. if they're forced to divest, because of the fact that that operation is such a small share of overall profits. It's also interesting to note that the retaliation in many ways has already occurred. I mean, China has been harassing U.S. tech companies operating inside the country for years. You know, Google, Facebook, they don't really compete, if they're in there at all, on a level playing field. There is a threat for things like Apple's operation or Tesla or other big U.S. companies, but none of those really rise to the level of being geopolitically important to the United States. And what I would expect to see are further decoupling and further bans of individual companies in both countries in the coming months and years.
What do you make of the increased action in the South China Sea, the fact that people are talking about some potential incursion on Taiwan in the foreseeable future? Do you think that China has the appetite to do that at a time where its economy isn't growing as much as they'd like?
We think something happened on the island of Taiwan is very unlikely. It just seems not like it's in China's interest to invade. It seems like they have a lot to lose. And if things go wrong, they're going to set themselves back significantly, both economically, but also diplomatically and geopolitically. However, there are a lot of sort of gray zone actions that they can take short of an actual incursion, including a blockade, which is, you know, not on the table right now, but that would be a significant challenge for Taiwan. They could also start doing more things to harass Taiwanese shipments going to the mainland or going to the United States, which could end up having a massive disruptive effect on commerce, even if the Chinese recognize what a huge mistake it would be to try to take Taiwan back by force right now.
This is a bigger question, I think, for the Europeans, John. I believe that someone notable was talking about this overnight. It might have been the NATO Secretary General, I forget, so forgive me. But comments about whether Europeans were making the same mistake with China that they made ultimately with Russia and relying too much on profits out of China. John, do they run that risk? And how big is that risk for the Europeans?
Absolutely. And look at who the leading edge is in both cases. It's Germany. So the Germans have done a lot of work in order to integrate their industrial base with China. China's an important market, and it's an important manufacturing hub for Germany as well. And, you know, you've got Olaf Scholz, who seems like he's out of step with the rest of the West and the rest of the Europeans in wanting to deepen and continue that relationship. What? So that's entirely possible. I actually think one of the interesting things coming out of a potential second Trump administration would be this increasing alienation between the Europeans and the United States on the issue of China. But, you know, we could have very different political leadership in Germany in a couple of years that may change course here. So there's a big risk that they're running right now of getting too reliant on China and losing one of their most important trading and economic partners in the United States.
What a moment. John, just wonderful to catch up with you, sir. Thank you. John Lieber there of Eurasia Group.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Let's get to Bruce Cassman of JP Morgan. Bruce, Lisa's been quoting you all morning. That quote is, the sound that you hear is a narrative cracking. How does this data inform that view?
Well, I think it's pretty supportive of that view on a number of fronts. Obviously, the one that people have been most focused on today is the inflation news. And certainly, we got a more distributed outcome of that surprise. It wasn't all in the March number. But the March number at 0.317 on an unrounded core is still pretty darn firm. I haven't seen all of the details as how that's distributed. I don't think the super core services were that high, at least what I see. But the basic point here is this is no longer something you can explain as just the beginning of the year pop. But I also emphasize two other things. One is, as you look at the data on income and spending here, we're getting very strong wage numbers. And I think there's probably some pressure here on wage inflation as well as there is the strong income numbers. We'll see the employment cost index report for the first quarter next week. And then the other thing here is we did have a squeeze on incomes to some degree, both for taxes and higher energy prices in Q1. And consumers held up pretty darn well. And one of the reasons is the savings rate went down. The savings rate is 3.2% in March. And I think that's a message that wealth effects are moving here. So there's both a story here about the economy holding up very well with high interest rates, as well as inflation pressures being persistent. And while I don't think it's right to talk about this from the point of view of Fed tightening, I think the case for Fed easing here is pretty small anytime soon. We'll see what we are 6 months from now. But certainly the Fed's going to have to change its tune about its view that there's a fair amount of easing that's coming down the road.
I would just add that real personal spending actually increased to 0.5% from 0.4%, even though it was expected to fall. Bruce, given the fact that we're seeing or hearing that sound of the narrative cracking, what's the new narrative? Is it just no rate cuts in your case?
Well, I think the clear part of the new narrative is high for long on rates. The question is, where does that take us? And we've been actually struggling with that. We have kind of two scenarios we think are both reasonable. One, we've been calling boil the frog, which is high interest rates do weigh on performance. They do start to create vulnerability on balance sheets, particularly the business sector side. And that causes problems for us, not now, but maybe 6 or 12 months from now. The second one is we find out that we actually can live with higher interest rates, that we've had better supply side performance. The economy is in an underlying resilient position, and that actually this is a new world, and we should understand that the economy has higher interest rates and is sustainable. Between those two right now, I think there's really support for both and some of the things we're seeing, and we're not trying to take a strong call on what the new narrative is going to be.
You do, though, think that there is going to be a new tone from the Federal Reserve next Wednesday when they give their press conference. What do you think is the right way to weigh the risks right now? How much should they shift away from what we saw in December?
Well, I think you have to remember that the May meeting is not a forecast round meeting. The May meeting is not one where we got a lot of new information since the last one. We really get a lot more with two payroll reports, two CPI reports up to the June meeting. So I think this is a bit of a way station. I think what Powell is going to do is he's going to basically say he's lost a lot of confidence in the views in terms of where inflation is going, but they haven't really shifted those views in a material way. He's going to downplay what the SCP in March was telling us, which still had three cuts for the year. And he's going to look to June for the bigger shift in the Fed. And obviously, we'll see that in the light of what we get in the next two sets of readings on both CPI and payrolls.
Just got a note, some reaction. This from Inflation Insight. The title of the note is just core PCE. Phew. I think a lot of people feel that way. Based on the information we got yesterday, there was a risk of a big upside surprise this morning, which is why we're basically saying that inline feels like a downside surprise relative to where expectations went to. That shift higher in yields yesterday, new highs for 2024. This morning, pulling back, particularly on a 10-year by 4 basis points, about 466 this morning. Bruce, I'm thinking who else is saying phew this morning. It's officials in the Ministry of Finance over in Japan. If they're looking at dollar yen, staying up at 156.87 and approaching 157, the last thing they needed was an upside surprise. Bruce, can we take this global? What are global central banks, finance ministries around the world staring down the barrel of this resilient, strong dollar? What are they going to do?
Well, first point to make here, which I think is really important, is we're seeing a world in which growth is broadening its base. And I think it is starting to take some of the weak links, including Japan and Western Europe, into a better position. I think in terms of what central banks are doing, there is more differentiation. We think the European inflation picture is looking a lot better than the U.S. So I think there is some room for easing. As you noted, Minister Finance is probably breathing a sigh of relief. I'm not sure they're that happy with the way the BOJ talked to us overnight. They were considerably more dovish than we expected in terms of their guidance. But I think the basic message here is you're going to get some easing in Western Europe. I think the BOJ is going to be patient here, but as you say, the yen is going to continue to be under downward pressure relative to the dollar. I think the pressure will build. I think ultimately Japan is going to do more and the economy is going to do better than people expect. And I'd say that more broadly about the global economy, that they'll do less on easing, the BOJ's tightening, and we'll get better global growth than people anticipate at this point.
I know this is a difficult question and everyone has a slightly different answer and some people say it's not relevant at all, but where are we in this cycle, in the economic cycle, if you're talking about a broadening out and affirming of Europe, of Japan, at a time when a lot of other people are talking about U.S. exceptionalism and the potential for late cycle types of behavior?
So I think we come back to this tension on high for long. And I think what's embedded in the high for long is an inflation dynamic, even once we've taken out the highs that we had in 21 and 22, and a position in terms of monetary policy, labor markets that screams late cycle. But I think what the pandemic has done is it's both created that dynamic as well as a far more positive dynamic in terms of where the positioning, in terms of leverage, durable spending, profit margins, things like that, that are normally late cycle signals that tight monetary policy is going to do damage. So I think we're in a kind of a weird new world of late cycle inflation in central banks and early mid-cycle private sector behavior. How that plays out, I'm not feeling very confident right now. As I said, I think there's this possibility of the boil the frog and we gradually grind to a problem. But there is a possibility we can sustain this for a while longer, a while being a few years.
Interesting. Bruce, thank you, sir. Bruce Kasman there.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more. Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Emily Rowland of John Hancock and Tech driving stocks higher. John Lieber of Eurasia as Secretary Blinken meets Xi in Beijing. And Gershon Distenfeld of AllianceBernstein looking for a rally in bonds. We begin with our top story this morning. Blockbuster tech earnings driving futures higher. Emily Rowland of John Hancock writing this. We have been married to tech stocks for years. It's been a successful relationship, but it may be time to date more cyclical parts of the market during this period of reaccelerating inflation growth. Emily, let's talk about why you want to cheat on something that is treating you so well this morning.
Well, after last night's earnings results, you know, the narrative has shifted a little bit. It almost feels like you're kind of married to Mr. Perfect here, right? You know, we know your company's doing great, earnings across tech and communications services coming in around 30 to 40%, but the stocks are starting to get a little flashy. We liked them more a few months ago when they were a bit more humble. So it's really about, you know, thinking about still owning these stocks. We're still in a relationship, but you might want to look around a little bit to see who's the next up and comer.
Are you saying there's red flags?
Not necessarily around the fundamentals. I mean, there's nothing wrong with tech. The earnings are great. It ranks really high on our quality metrics, things like return on equity. These companies have a ton of cash. It's just everybody's in love with them. Everybody wants to be married to them. So a lot of that's already been reflected in the price. We want to diversify away from that and own things that are actually trading on sale. And as the economy continues to chug along here, we think areas on the value complex, specifically the energy sector, deserves a look in portfolios.
if Mr. Perfect is Mr. Perfect, why leave him? I mean, honestly, you have to realize that at a certain point, if we're not going to get rate cuts, if it's not going to look better elsewhere, is it just sort of to see what else is out there for the sake of seeing what else is out there, but Mr. Perfect ultimately is the one to be with?
I got to be careful with this analogy to make sure my husband's not listening to it. But you know how these marriages go after a little while. You guys know we've been married to tech for a long time, and we're going to continue to have that relationship. There's no doubt about it, especially given our preference for quality and given our preference for U.S. equities over international. We simply have the best earnings here in the United States, and a lot of that's been driven by tech. So it's not about abandoning the relationship. It's just about looking around a little bit to see what areas of the market actually have been left in the dust and might benefit from this modest reacceleration we're seeing in economic growth and demand globally. And we think that on the value side, those stocks have been ignored.
I'm going to have to bite my tongue in taking this analogy further, so I will leave that there for now. I am curious, though, at what point this idea of diversification is really predicated on a rate-cutting cycle, even if it only is one that starts this year. Does that idea of diversification working fail if you get the idea of no rate cuts this year and potentially much higher rates for longer?
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, the idea that we're looking at is that, you know, we had this massive momentum Fed pivot party, you know, driven rally, and really tech and growth were the biggest beneficiaries of that. At one point, the S&P 500 growth index was trading at a 45% premium to its long-term average. And really a lot of that was predicated on the idea that growth was slowing and that rates were going to get cut. The higher for longer narrative to us really speaks to the idea of diversification and seeing some participation from areas that really did not participate in that momentum-driven pivot party rally. So I think, you know, if in a higher for longer environment, which it looks like we're here to stay, we do think that more cyclical areas deserve a look in portfolios.
Well, let's have a look at energy this morning. So Exxon came out with earnings in the last hour or so. EPS in at $2.06, the estimate $2.19. It's a small miss. The stock is a little bit lower in the pre-market. Is that where you want to be?
Yeah, we do think it looks like, you know, energy can do well here. You know, those companies in general have a lot more capital discipline. You know, for years, energy companies were just pumping more money into producing more oil. And now there's a lot more use of that capital, whether it's CapEx, whether it's investment or whether it's producing dividends for investors. So we think, you know, certainly the portfolio managers that we work with, the John Hancock, have done a great job being active in that space. And it's, you know, feels like a little bit of a 2022 playbook right now with the stagflation narrative coming to the forefront. And of course, we know that energy was really the only winner that year in addition to the US dollar and cash. And we want to be mindful of that.
How much weight do you put on the stagflation narrative of yesterday?
I think it's, you know, there's whiffs of it, John. You know, obviously the first reaction, and it felt like a roller coaster ride yesterday, as everybody started digging further into the GDP data and deciding it wasn't really all that bad and inflation wasn't all that bad. I think that was the gut reaction. You know, the missing piece to this, the twist on the stagflation argument, is that the labor market is so resilient. Everyone was focused on GDP yesterday, but initial claims came in at 207,000. That is like the jobs market saying there's nothing to see here. Of course, the unemployment rate's still well below 4%. So the economy's doing okay. You know, you look under the hood at GDP, final demand was really robust. Consumer and business spending still doing well. There were some pieces of the pie that weren't so great. The economy's chugging along here. So I think we're still not at stagflation yet, but there's kind of some whiffs in the air.
I'm trying to just imagine your investing life. So you're married to Mr. Perfect. You're dating the hot thing, which is commodities. How often do you go visit the parents, which is the bond market? I mean, basically, where does that fit in to this whole equation?
Yeah, so you know that we've continued to emphasize bonds and portfolios. You know, the fact that you can get paid to wait in this never-ending late cycle environment to us is really attractive. We think we'll continue to see some chop in rates from here as we, you know, look at how long it's taking to get back down to the Fed's 2% target in inflation, growth picking up again modestly here. It's not great, but the fact that you can earn 5%+ and income owning the aggregate bond index, that's something that we haven't been able to say in a really long time. So we think it makes sense to lean into bonds. get paid to wait, because this cycle likely ends the way that it always does, which something will break. It's just really hard to see that right now.
Lisa, who are the kids? Foreign exchange, the Japanese yen.
Bitcoin.
Where's this going? Bitcoin, crypto.
Yeah. NFTs.
Oh, you're going to make friends this morning.
Carry on. Well, I mean, I love it. Dating the hot thing, commodities. How long can that last? That's sort of what everybody loves.
He's too perfect.
I want to go into that.
Do you
really
want to clean
further.
That up?
Yeah, exactly.
He's too perfect,
which means what exactly? That, like, why don't you want him to, you know?
Men the world over want to know what is too perfect.
And honestly, and babysit, frankly, crypto.
Emily, we're going to go. Emily Rowland.
There you go.
John Hancock, this is your fault. Thank you.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast, bringing you the best in markets, economics, and geopolitics. You can watch the show live on Bloomberg TV weekday mornings from 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. Eastern. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen. And as always, on the Bloomberg Terminal and the Bloomberg Business App.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.